Greetings and welcome to Season 1, Episode 5 of That's What I Think, But I Could Be Wrong, The Immigration Controversy. My name is Todd Lorenz, and this is my show. I drop a new episode every Thursday. It's available first thing in the morning. I think cryptids exist that science should recognize. I don't think Lee Harvey Oswald had a thing to do with the murder of John F. Kennedy. I don't think we know the truth about what happened on 9/11. I think the United States should meddle in foreign affairs as little as possible. And I believe the vast majority of politicians are corrupt. But hey, that's just what I think. And I could be wrong.
That's what I think, but I could be wrong. That's what I thought when I wrote this song. I say what I believe and I say it strong. That's what I think, but I could be wrong.
Ah, there we go. Music to soothe your soul, or at least soothe mine. Or at least music to make me question pretty much everything. Hey, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening. Thanks for streaming. Thanks for downloading. Thank you for supporting my show. If you haven't already given me a positive review or a good star rating on the media of your choice, please do so. It helps me grow the show, and that is both necessary and appreciated. The topic this week is the immigration controversy, something I've seen discussed greatly in the news when I choose to pay attention, which is very, very rare. And perhaps more importantly to a lot of people, at least this seems to be how they get their news, sometimes so do I, sadly, it's setting social media ablaze, which is why I chose to look at it this week. Now, for the record, I am pro-legal immigration. I am anti-illegal immigration. What exactly do I mean by that? Well, it's simple. I'm in favor of people coming to this country through legal means. If you come here illegally, you're breaking the law, and you should not be here. Now, with all the controversy about immigration I've seen lately and all the furor and hubbub about families being separated, that seems to be an issue that I don't see being mentioned, and some are offended when I bring it up. And I don't understand that. Should we just open up our borders and have a free-for-all? I don't think so, but there are those who are in favor of it, and historically speaking, it used to be that way, but I'll get into that more later. I think part of the problem, perhaps, and again, I could be wrong, is the way language has changed just during my lifetime. When I was a kid, people that are now called undocumented immigrants were referred to as illegal aliens. Obviously, that's changed. It's gone from illegal aliens to illegal immigrants, and now undocumented immigrants. Now, I'm okay with not calling people aliens. Even as a kid, that always brought to mind men from outer space, little green suckers, you know, whatever. But to say that they're not illegal, but rather undocumented, I don't care for it. But, as it turns out, there may be a legal basis for it. Is illegal immigration actually a crime? Let's take a look at that. As always, my references are listed on the show notes page. You can find that by going to toddlorenz.com, toddlorenz.com. Okay then, so those who violate our nation's laws by unlawfully crossing U.S. borders have entered the country illegally. This is a misdemeanor, and if repeated after being deported, becomes punishable as a felony. So yes, it is illegal immigration. It's against the law. However, as it turns out, unlawful presence in this country is not a crime. It's a civil violation. Unlawful presence is neither a felony nor a misdemeanor. It is a civil infraction that results in removal and a bar on re-entry for a certain period of time. That was new to me, and it seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? Kind of feels like, well, it's a crime to get here illegally, but once you're here, if we catch you, maybe we'll deport you. Good luck. Doesn't seem right, does it? But I can see where some might believe the phrase undocumented immigrants might be more accurate than illegal immigrants. But to me, if you're here and it's undocumented, you came here unlawfully, and that's a crime, you should be deported. But once they are here illegally, are they a problem? Are they more likely to commit crimes? Well, apparently our president... Oh, Donald Trump. No, I'm not a supporter. I think the guy's a buffoon and a disgrace, but that's a topic for another show. But apparently he thinks that they are more likely to commit crimes. According to an article on factcheck.org, President Donald Trump said it's not true that immigrants in the U.S. illegally are safer than the people that live in the country, providing several crime statistics he claimed represented the toll of illegal immigration. Senator Bernie Sanders made the opposite claim, saying, "I understand that the crime rate among undocumented people is actually lower than the general population." This article explores who is correct. Now, part of the problem is that there are not readily available statistics on this issue. The Justice Department keeps data on federal crimes committed by immigrants in the country illegally, and an analysis from the U.S. Sentencing Commission found that undocumented immigrants made up a disproportionate share of federal inmates sentenced for non-immigration crimes in 2016. But the vast majority of crimes, more than 90%, are dealt with at the state and local level, where those kinds of data are harder to come by because those jurisdictions rarely record whether prisoners are immigrants in the country illegally. Now, Trump's case, he did not cite any kind of study that attempts to show whether illegal immigration is associated with more crime. Instead, he provided statistics on the number of crimes committed by all non-citizens, whether they are in the country illegally or legally. His quote is as follows. So here are just a few statistics on the human toll of illegal immigration. According to a 2011 government report, the arrests attached to the criminal alien population included an estimated 25,000 people for homicide, 42,000 for robbery, nearly 70,000 for sex offenses, and nearly 15,000 for kidnapping. In Texas alone, within the last 7 years, more than 250,000 criminal aliens have been arrested and charged with over 600,000 criminal offenses. You don't hear that. I always hear that, oh no, the population's safer than the people that live in the country. You heard that, fellas, right? You've heard that. I hear it so much and I say, is that possible? The answer is it's not true. You hear it's like they're better people than what we have, than our citizens. It's not true. Well, here's the problem with what Trump said. Trump's whole point was that it's not true that immigrants in the U.S. illegally are safer than the people that live in the country. And then he provided a bunch of numbers to document his case. Well, he didn't compare them to anything. He just said, look at all these bad things that illegal immigrants do. How does that compare to the crimes committed by legal residents? It's not like we're all angels here. It's not like there's no crime except for what illegal immigrants do. Come on now, Trump. Use your head. Well, yeah, all right, never mind. There is some research showing the arrest rate for illegal immigrants was 40% below that of native-born Americans. That comes from Alex Nauriste with the Libertarian Cato Institute. In addition, he wrote, the homicide rate for native, non-born Americans was about 46% higher than the illegal immigrant homicide arrest rate. Think about that for a second. All in all, research from the Cato Institute concluded that illegal immigrants are 47% less likely to be incarcerated than natives. Another study, titled Does Undocumented Immigration Increase Violent Crime, concludes that increased concentrations of undocumented immigrants are associated with statistically significant decreases in violent crime. Maybe they're just trying to stay under the radar, you know? They don't want to get caught and kicked out of the country. They want to stay here, which is why they came in the first place. However, there is some conflicting research. John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, looked at data on prisoners in Arizona State Prison between the beginning of 1985 and June of 2017 and concluded that undocumented immigrants are at least 146% more likely to be convicted of crime than other Arizonans. They also tend to commit more serious crimes and have significantly higher rates for such crimes as murder, manslaughter, sexual assault, and armed robbery, and are more likely to be gang members. Conversely, Lott found that legal immigrants were extremely law-abiding, committing crimes at a lower rate than native-born residents. Lott's research is contested by the Cato Institute. They argued that Lott's study has a fatal flaw in its assumption that it was able to, quote, identify illegal immigrants, end quote, from the data. The article on factcheck.org, I'm quoting here, concludes by saying, there aren't readily available nationwide crime statistics broken down by immigration status, but the available research that estimates the relationship between illegal immigration and crime generally shows an association with lower crime rates. The impetus is on the president to provide evidence of his claim, and Trump instead simply cited statistics on violent crime committed by all non-citizens without attempting to compare those figures to crimes committed by native-born citizens. There you go. Look, I don't think Trump is a complete idiot, but I doubt he's a critical thinker. If I were guessing, I'd say he asked for someone to provide some statistics to back up his belief. They gave him what he spouted, and he was satisfied. So, are illegal immigrants more likely to commit crimes than legal residents? There doesn't seem to be conclusive evidence, but it looks like the answer is no. So, why are people entering the country illegally? Is it really that hard to get in? Well, let's take a look at that and find out. To the interwebs for answers. I'm looking at the usa.gov/enter-us website, or webpage, I guess. And it gives fairly simple instructions for how to enter the U.S., including how to apply for a visa, apply for an immigrant visa, the Presidential Proclamation on Immigration, procedures for entering the United States, and information about refugees and asylum. Now, how to apply for a visa? Well, there are several categories. There are business or professional visas for citizens of Canada and Mexico, visitor visas for tourism or business, visas for students, immigrant visa for permanent residency, transit visa for traveling through the U.S. on your way to visit another country, and fiancé visa to marry your U.S. citizen fiancé and live in the United States. As I understand it, one of the biggest sources of undocumented immigrants or illegal immigrants is people who have visas that expire and remain in the country without renewing them. Now, it says on the page that Customs and Border Protection officers conduct arrival inspections using the same criteria for all foreign nationals visiting the United States, or U.S. They decide your admission, even if all your travel documents, including your visa, are in order. While there are no rules prohibiting pregnant visitors from entering the United States, doing so to give birth is prohibited. A Customs Border Protection officer will consider your pregnancy when deciding on your admission. That used to be a big thing. I don't know if it still is. They called them anchor babies. I studied this back in high school and some while I was in college. People would come to the United States, give birth, and have children that were now citizens, which made it easier for them to stay. Now, applying for an immigrant visa seems to be relatively simple. If you're seeking permanent resident status in the United States, the process you'll follow will depend on whether you're already in the U.S. If you're in the U.S., you do not have to apply for an immigrant visa. Instead, you will apply for a permanent resident or green card through an adjustment of status. The advantage of this is that you won't have to return to your home country to complete visa processing. If you're outside the U.S., you will apply for an immigrant visa through consular processing with a U.S. Department of State embassy or consulate abroad. Both procedures involve several key steps. 1. In most cases, someone must sponsor you or file an immigration petition for you. Two, once the petition is approved and there is a visa available in your category, you apply for either a green card or an immigrant visa. Three, you get a medical examination. Four, you go to an interview. Five, you receive a decision on your application. Granted, it doesn't say anywhere how long this all takes, and I doubt it's quite that simple, but at least there's a process in place. And like with any government process or bureaucracy, I'm sure there's lots of red tape and forms, and it's a giant pain in the backside. But that's the price you pay for coming here legally, which I suppose is why they do it illegally. Now, there's different types of immigrant visas. Most who come here using an immigrant visa receive one of the following: a family-based visa, which is based on a family relationship with a U.S. citizen or permanent residence, or an employment-based visa, which generally requires a job offer from a U.S. employer. Another popular way to seek an immigrant visa is through the Diversity Visa Lottery Program. This program allows foreign citizens from countries with low immigration rates to the United States to participate in an annual random drawing for an immigrant visa. Now then, after you get your immigrant visa, you have to pay a USCIS immigrant fee before you'll receive your green card. The best time to pay the fee is after you pick up your immigrant visa from the Department of State Embassy or Consulate abroad and before you depart for the United States. When you receive your immigrant visa, you'll get a sealed immigrant visa packet of documents, which you'll give to officials at the U.S. port of entry. If you pass inspection, you'll be admitted to the U.S. as a permanent resident and will receive your green card in the mail. Now, oddly enough, the fee was not listed on this simple and easy page of bullet points and explanations, but I was able to find it, and it's $220. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot, but to someone with practically nothing, it's a small fortune, maybe even a large fortune. So what about refugees and asylum? Well, refugees are people who fled their homes for a variety of reasons, including persecution and war, to find protection elsewhere. If you believe you need protection as a refugee, contact the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees or another international nonprofit volunteer agency. If these organizations are unavailable to you, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. The refugee's entry process into the United States involves many government agencies as part of the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, which explains the resettlement and a refugee's arrival. There is a page discussing the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, but it doesn't seem to provide a whole lot of information. But again, there's a process in place. People should go through it. Now, if they're being denied access to that process, that's another discussion. So what about asylum? You must meet certain conditions to request asylum in the United States. Once you get asylum, you can get permission to bring your spouse and children to the U.S. or become a permanent resident. And of course, there is a process outlined. And again, I'm sure it's not this simple or easy to obtain asylum in this country. But should it be? Well, again, that's another discussion. We do have laws in place, and it's my opinion that they should be respected, observed, and enforced. If you think the laws should be changed, well, there's a process for that, too. Is it simple or easy? No, probably not, and it probably shouldn't be. It's not exactly a snap to get a law passed to begin with. It shouldn't be very easy to remove it or change it either, but there is a way. Now, I understand that immigrating to this country wasn't always as difficult as it is now, and it has changed over the years. Until 1882, there basically was no federal immigration law. Anyone who arrived was welcome to make their life in the U.S. There were no visas necessary, no consulting with the U.S. consulate. You boarded a boat, and you built your new life in the U.S. Or you came across from Mexico, whatever. That began the change in 1882 with the Chinese Exclusion Act, when the Congress decided that immigrants from China, who some argued were biologically inferior to Europeans, should be kept out altogether. Over the next four decades, we gradually restricted further groups, the poor, the sick, the uneducated, those suspected of holding questionable ideologies, until in 1924, Congress enacted a new immigration quota system that drastically limited immigration. It became extremely difficult to migrate, especially if you were from a country outside of the northern and western European countries that were granted the vast majority of the limited number of visas made available. 1924. Well, maybe that had something to do with the oncoming depression. Just a thought. That changed again in 1965 when President Johnson signed into law a dramatic overhaul of the U.S. immigration system again. America could not and would not go back to an era of open borders, Johnson said as he signed the law, but the new law would base eligibility to immigrate not primarily on race or country of origin, but rather on family connections and employability. In the nearly 50 years since that last overhaul, the system has worked fairly well for some people, spouses, minor children, and parents of adult U.S. citizen and highly skilled workers with advanced degrees who could find an employer sponsor, for example. But particularly as our economy has grown, but visa quotas have not, the system is not working very well today. Because the quota numbers are much lower than demand, family members can wait up to 20 years to be reunited through the proper legal channels in some cases. The employment-based system is equally dysfunctional, particularly for low-skilled workers. Under the law, a maximum of 5,000 permanent visas are available per year for employer-sponsored workers other than those who were highly skilled or holding advanced degrees. The problem is that our economy produces many, many times more jobs for people considered low-skilled, jobs that require little to no education but a willingness to do very hard work, than there are visas. To put things in perspective, back in 1910, 5,000 individuals, most of whom today would be classified as low-skilled, entered through Ellis Island in an average day. So why hasn't the system changed in the last 50 years? I think it all comes back to one word, money. It always comes back to money. There are more low-skilled jobs than there are people willing to do them in this country. At least that's what this essay or article is stating. Do I agree? Well, probably. Yeah, I do. I know there are certain jobs I won't do, but never mind that for now. I suppose if I get desperate enough, that'll change. It ties into paying a decent minimum wage. Not only do these low-skilled, illegal workers perform very difficult labor, they are drastically underpaid for what they do. Employers who use them don't want to change that. Now, they'll argue that they must do it to remain competitive with overseas productions of various sorts and whatever and blah, 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 and okay, fine. I'm not going to get into those arguments. I will say this. I've made this statement before many times throughout my life. If you really wanted to end illegal immigration, you heavily fine employers who use illegal immigrants. You change things so it's not cost-effective for them to employ undocumented workers. I promise you, people will stop coming here illegally if they stop having a reason. And most of them are coming here for money and opportunity. If those go away, they'll stop coming. What would that do to our economy? That's a whole nother discussion I'm not getting into now. That also would not affect those seeking asylum. In fact, let's take another look at asylum. I'm looking at an article titled Seeking Asylum in the U.S. Under Trump. It appears on PBS.org and is dated May the 1st of this year. Michelle Stilwell, a civil rights attorney, says asylum seekers typically come from a wide range of cultural background and socioeconomic status. These are people that are overlooked by their own government that can't seek help in their own country, so they're literally coming here just to save their lives and to live in some sort of relative safety. Now that's what the asylum program is designed for, to help these types of people. However, like any system, it is abused. Opponents, including Trump, have argued that immigrants take advantage of the system to gain entry into the U.S. Quote, people come here and they put in a claim for political asylum without merit because it will get them to the United States. End quote. That comes from Ira Melman, the media director of the Conservative Federation for American Immigration Reform. Now, what's changed recently? There's been a virtual firestorm of shocking images of children being separated from their families and horrible stories about wait times and people living in cages, Which, by the way, we put people in cages all the time in this country for committing crimes. It's not uncommon. Well, applications for asylum have increased in recent years. According to the Department of Homeland Security, the number of new asylum applicants rose from 43,312 in fiscal year 2012 to 141,695 in fiscal year 2017. That is known as a substantial increase. The rise in applications has changed the way asylum cases are processed in the courts, according to Victoria Slatton, an immigration attorney. After filing the application, asylum seekers join a waiting list to interview with an officer from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. In the past, the process, from filing the application to receiving a final answer approving or rejecting the request, typically took roughly 60 days. But in recent years, what used to be a 60-day waiting period became anywhere from a 2 to 5 year waiting period. That is also a substantial increase. It's a matter of the demand not being able to be met by the current system. But the Trump administration did make some changes. In January, they said they would prioritize processing recently filed asylum applications over those that have been pending for years. The new policy is often called last in, first out. U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services has said the shift was made to eliminate the backlog of asylum cases. In a statement in January, the agency said the backlog had reached 311,000 pending asylum cases. So it's not like nothing was being done, but last in, first out just seems logical, doesn't it? Why is a policy change necessary? Why isn't that the default? So what should be done about it? Should we revamp the system? Well, I'll get into that more with my conclusion later. Right now, I want to get into the main reason I decided to address the immigration topic on my podcast, separating families. There is a huge public outcry about this. Before I did this podcast, I looked at a few websites, CNN and a few other news sites, to kind of get an idea of what was happening, why there was such an uproar, and I've done a little more research for this show. I'm looking at an article on the Washington Post's website. It's titled, "The Facts About Trump's Policy of Separating Families at the Border," and is dated June the 19th of this year. It says, "The president and top administration officials say U.S. laws or court rulings are forcing them to separate families that are caught trying to cross the southern border. These claims are false. Immigrant families are being separated primarily because the Trump administration in April began to prosecute as many border crossing offenses as possible. This zero-tolerance policy applies to all adults, regardless of whether they cross alone or with their children. The Justice Department can't prosecute children along with their parents, so the natural result of the zero-tolerance policy has been a sharp rise in family separations. Nearly 2,000 immigrant children were separated from parents during 6 weeks in April and May, according to the Department of Homeland Security. The Trump administration implemented this policy by choice and could end it by choice. No law or court ruling mandates family separations. In fact, during its first 15 months, the Trump administration released nearly 100,000 immigrants who were apprehended at the U.S.-Mexican border, a total that includes more than 37,500 unaccompanied minors and more than 61,000 family members." Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen tweeted and then said at a White House briefing that the administration does not have a policy of separating families at the border, but that's the inevitable consequence, as Nielsen and other Trump administration officials acknowledge. "Operationally, what that means is we will have to separate your family," Nielsen told NPR in May. "That's no different than what we do every day in every part of the United States when an adult of a family commits a crime. If you, as a parent, break into a house, you will be incarcerated by police and thereby separated from your family. We're doing the same thing at the border." Now, the article goes on and discusses the issue some more in immigration laws and acts and how illegal immigrants are dealt with in the system. I'm not going to get into it all. I'll leave a link on my website on my show notes page so you can check that out at your convenience. But that last point was something I wanted to make and something I'm going to come back to. Now, the public outcry has caused the Trump administration to make some changes. Now I'm looking at an article dated June 30th from Vox.com titled, "It's Official, the Trump Administration Has Replaced Family Separation with Indefinite Family Detention." Subheading, in a new court filing, Trump's Department of Justice says it's now legally allowed to detain migrant families no matter how long their cases take. The Trump administration is arguing that a court order preventing family separation gives them the legal power to keep families together in immigration detention indefinitely. Article says also that family detention has always been Plan A, but the Flores agreement kept Trump from doing it. Donald Trump and his officials have argued for months that they should have the power to detain migrant families who cross the U.S.-Mexico border together until their immigration cases are completed, and they claim they separated thousands of families over the past several months, with 65 families separated a day during the peak of the policy, only because they weren't allowed to detain them together. The executive order Trump signed June 20, which he claimed would end family separation, was in fact an instruction for the executive branch to start finding as much space as possible for family detention. It also told the Department of Justice to ask U.S. District Judge Dolly Gee to reverse her own 2015 Flores settlement ruling that prevented the government from keeping children in immigration detention longer than necessary, even when they were being held with their parents. The Trump administration says it has two choices: detain families or separate them. Well, I can see a third choice: just send them back. If you want to process them and put them through the system, the legal system, then say that everybody has rights and deserves a trial, fine. It's not easy to do that. It takes resources, it takes space, it takes money, and this is what we're having to do because it's what the laws dictate. Speaking of money, the federal government is already working to build temporary facilities on military bases to house thousands of migrant families. The Department of Homeland Security has asked the Pentagon to provide space for 2,000 detainees within 45 days. Ultimately, it wants space to detain 12,000 more people in family detention. Existing family detention facilities have space for about 1,500. And see, that's what I'm talking about, resources. We're not even talking about feeding these people. We're just talking about housing them to give them the due process they deserve according to our laws for breaking our laws. For coming here illegally, this is what we have to do. If Trump follows President Barack Obama's lead, families in detention will be rammed through an expedited legal process. That would be disastrous for due process. Pro bono lawyers who went to temporary family facilities in 2014 reported that it was all but impossible for families to get due process for their asylum claims, with only one lawyer for every 120 detainees and immigration judges trying to keep lawyers out of the room during their clients' hearings. Well, if you're going to have a lawyer, they kind of need to be present. That's fundamental to me. If Trump wants to provide a full legal process or simply doesn't have the resources to expedite it, it will mean months or years in detention for many families. The long-term detention of immigration children raises some of the same concerns that keeping them in custody without their parents does in terms of trauma. The Trump administration isn't fighting to separate families, it's fighting to detain them. The question is whether the latter is something that critics of family separation will see as an acceptable solution, and what they'll do if it isn't. So let's go ahead and wrap this up. Separating families was the nearly unavoidable result of having to process them, but policies were changed and public reaction is still pending. The system is currently overrun. Those who would come here should perhaps be made aware of the wait times, and maybe when they're taken into custody, they should be given the option of returning home. Do we want to expend the resources necessary to house, feed, and process the number of immigrants currently overwhelming the system? I don't think so. We have our own problems to address, and I believe they should take priority. Our national debt is horrific, and increasing with no relief in sight. Do we really want to add to it? I say no, but if we as a people say yes, then the laws should be changed. Every country in the world has the right to defend their borders, and many have stricter laws than we do. Most don't have the same demand. Now, some believe we should simply open the borders, let anyone in who wants to come, no matter how many of them there are. But I disagree. However, it would be a solution. What would I do? While our system is overwhelmed, I turn people away, send them back. When they're here illegally, take them back to the border and set them loose. If they're not from Canada or Mexico, that's not our problem. They found their way here, they can find their way home. I'd hit companies who hire illegals with hefty fines, amounts large enough to make it impractical and unprofitable to hire illegal immigrants. Hopefully, that would encourage those in other countries to address their issues instead of fleeing. Fix your own house before you come to mine. In fact, maybe if you did fix your house, maybe you wouldn't even want to come to mine. Wouldn't that be better for everybody? But you know, that's just what I think. And I could be wrong.
That's what I think, but I could be wrong. That's what I thought when I wrote this song. I say what I believe and I say it's wrong. That's what I think, but I could be wrong.
Thank you for listening. I truly appreciate it. And I'd really love a positive review on Apple Podcasts or whatever media you use to get to my show. It'll help me grow the podcast and hopefully monetize it within the reasonably near future. If you did not like the show, well, tell you what, why don't you try another episode? Maybe you'll enjoy it more. I can be reached at podcast@toddlorenz.com. My website is toddlorenz.com. You'll find this show along with all of my music. Speaking of which, the song we're going to go out with this week is from The Life and Times of Snuffy Wilson, a concept album about a fictional blues man I released back on December 5th of 2010. The song is called Need to Be Free. Enjoy, and I'll talk to you next week.
I need to be free from what's shackled in me. Imprisoning my soul. Life is these worlds of deceit. No compassion in a corporate soul. When I was younger, living hand to mouth, never thought I'd be a robot in a queue. Nothing better to do than try to find a way out. Stifles me, strangles my soul. No time for passion, creativity. It destroys my soul. When I was younger, living on the road, never thought I'd be old. before my time, what a senseless crime. I need to leave my home.